Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show where we cut through the noise and get straight to the heart of what's happening. I'm Lee Graham, your guide, ready to navigate today's complex landscape.
And I'm Sam Hurst, here to help connect the dots, distill key insights, and explore the broader implications of the stories we uncover for you.
Today, we're embarking on a crucial deep dive into the pages of The Washington Post for Tuesday, September 2nd, 2025. Our mission, as always, is to take this stack of sources, these articles, in-depth research, and, well, our own extensive notes, and meticulously extract the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight.
Right.
Our goal is to give you a true shortcut to being exceptionally well-informed, offering surprising facts, and just enough humor, hopefully, to keep you utterly hooked.
It's definitely more than just a newspaper review. It's a crucial, multifaceted snapshot of a world that feels very much in flux right now.
Absolutely.
We'll be navigating a turbulent and, yeah, often dramatic political landscape right here at home, where some foundational principles are really being tested.
And we'll also look abroad.
Exactly. We'll examine complex and significant shifts in global power dynamics, exploring how different nations are trying to reshape the international order.
And of course, we won't miss the other stuff.
No, never. As always, we'll uncover truly fascinating stories spanning technology, the world of sports, and those deeply human experiences that, you know, often offer the most poignant insights, but can sometimes get lost in the sheer volume of the daily news cycle.
Okay, let's unpack this with a headline that immediately grabs your attention. Our front page today features a really significant piece about President Trump's relentless quest for expanded executive power. A pursuit that is now posing a major, maybe even unprecedented, test for the nation's highest court. The article meticulously details three distinct yet interconnected areas where the executive branch is pushing constitutional boundaries, really redefining the limits of its authority.
Right.
First up, the Federal Reserve and the deeply controversial firing of Governor Lisa Cook.
What's immediately striking here is how these seemingly disparate cases, you've got a central bank governor, international tariffs, the allocation of foreign aid, they all converge on one singular profound theme. The bold redefinition of executive authority.
Exactly.
Peter Shane, a highly respected law professor at NYU, he doesn't mince words. He describes Trump's assertions of power as breathtaking.
Yeah, breathtaking. Yeah. Wow.
Precisely because they directly challenge what has historically been, you know, for centuries, regarded as a core power of Congress.
Right.
This brings us to a fundamental question. How far is the Supreme Court truly willing to go to endorse this assertion of executive authority? And maybe more critically, what are the long-term implications for the, well, the delicate balance of power that underpins our entire governmental structure? This isn't just about this administration. It's about the future of checks and balances.
That's the core of it, isn't it? On the Lisa Cook case specifically, President Trump issued an executive order alleging sufficient cause for her removal, citing false statements on mortgage applications back in 2021. Now, that's a period before she was even nominated to the Fed board.
Which is a key detail.
It is. And historically, the Supreme Court has indicated that Federal Reserve governors could only be removed for cause, a standard intended to protect the agency's independence from political interference.
Right. That independence is crucial.
It makes Cook's firing an undeniable red line test for the 111-year-old agency's cherished independence. Cook herself has vehemently called her removal unprecedented and illegal, arguing quite forcefully that it's a thinly veiled pretext to reshape the Fed board with individuals more amenable to lower interest rates, a move she believes is politically motivated.
Which is the accusation.
Exactly. A federal judge heard her injunction request, essentially, a plea for a temporary court order to immediately block her unprecedented removal just last Friday, with the decision still pending.
And that interpretation of for cause is going to be absolutely pivotal here, because critically, the term isn't actually defined in the Federal Reserve Act itself.
Right. It's vague.
It is. And it has never before been fully litigated in the Supreme Court. So Trump administration officials are arguing that the court should be highly deferential, meaning, you know, they should grant significant respect and leeway, often avoiding second guessing to the president's determination.
So just accept his reasoning.
Essentially contending that his rationale for removal shouldn't be scrutinized or challenged by the judiciary. This could set an extraordinary precedent for how future presidents interact with independent agencies.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine the implications if a president could simply declare cause for almost any reason, effectively dismantling institutional independence at will.
It's a chilling thought.
This case truly highlights the fragility of, you know, unwritten norms and the power of interpretation in constitutional law.
Then we move to the ongoing economic battlefront, tariffs and trade. Last week, an appeals court actually struck down most of Trump's sweeping tariffs on foreign goods, declaring them illegal.
That was a big ruling.
It was huge. These began initially with targeted tariffs on China, Mexico, and Canada, but then dramatically expanded to include a universal 10% import tax, plus significantly higher rates on products from about 60 other countries. Trump had famously dubbed this expansion Liberation Day.
Right.
The administration has consistently used the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEPA, which was originally designed for sanctions in times of national emergency to assert what it claims is virtually unlimited authority on tariffs.
Which is a bold claim.
It's a direct frontal challenge to the U.S. Constitution, which unambiguously grants Congress the exclusive power to levy taxes on imports. Trump's specific argument for deploying this immense power, that large and persistent trade deficits constitute an unusual and extraordinary threat to national security.
The appeals court's ruling was quite unequivocal on this point, though. It explicitly stated that the IEPA bestows significant authority on the president to undertake a number of actions in response to a declared national emergency. But none of these actions explicitly include the power to impose tariffs, duties, or the like, or the power to tax.
So, no tariffs power there.
Exactly. This judicial pushback truly brings into sharp focus that long-standing historical tension between executive and legislative powers, particularly when it comes to taxation and trade policy.
And for our listeners.
Well, the broader implication for you, the listener, is that these tariffs aren't abstract economic theory. They directly impact the price of everything from consumer electronics to cars, because import taxes are almost always passed on to the buyer.
Right. We pay for it.
Yeah. Moreover, they can provoke retaliatory tariffs from other countries, hurting American exporters and potentially leading to job losses in those sectors.
And finally, on this executive power front, we're observing the administration's continued push to withhold tens of billions of dollars in foreign aid.
Ah, yes, the aid issue.
Which Congress had already fully appropriated. This has, predictably, led to ongoing and significant legal battles. Most recently, the administration employed a tactic called a pocket rescission.
A pocket rescission, okay.
Now, this is a controversial method where the executive branch effectively impounds funds already appropriated by Congress, basically letting them expire without a formal veto.
So they just don't spend it.
Right, thereby unilaterally canceling about $5 billion in foreign aid without any legislative approval. This move has drawn widespread bipartisan criticism. Even prominent Republican leaders, like Senator Susan Collins, have openly called it a clear violation of the law.
Collins, too. Okay.
Attorneys representing the plaintiffs in these cases contend that the administration intends to run out the clock on these allocated funds, ultimately harming the most vulnerable people in the world who rely on this aid.
That phrase, run out the clock, highlights a deeply troubling pattern if these actions are indeed calculated attempts to sidestep congressional intent and appropriations.
It does seem deliberate.
This isn't merely about abstract legal theory or, you know, procedural minutia. It has tangible, immediate impacts. We're talking about the effectiveness of U.S. foreign policy, the integrity of the appropriations process itself, and crucially, the very real human consequences for aid recipients in desperate situations.
Yeah.
If the executive can unilaterally ignore congressional spending mandates, it fundamentally undermines Congress's constitutional power of the purse and reshapes the entire dynamic of foreign aid. It's a significant test of interbranch authority.
These domestic power struggles around the presidency's reach inevitably have ripple effects, not just on our economy, but profoundly on how the U.S. is perceived on the global stage.
Absolutely. Perception matters.
And speaking of that global stage, our next major story takes us to China, which is actively attempting to capitalize on perceived U.S. internal divisions and, well, potential isolationist tendencies to reshape the global order. This is highlighted by a fascinating piece about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit.
What's particularly revealing here is that this summit isn't just about forging new economic deals or security partnerships. It's a highly political message being broadcast globally.
A message to whom?
Well, Klaus Sohn, a seasoned analyst at the Mercator Institute for China Studies, encapsulates it succinctly. It's a powerful statement that the West is not the dominating power or the sole answer to global governance.
Pushing back against the U.S.-led order.
Exactly. Furthermore, it serves as a critical opportunity for leaders currently under extensive Western sanctions, like Russia's President Putin and Iran's President Pezeshkian, to demonstrably show that they are not isolated on the global stage, pushing back against Western pressure.
So a club for sanctioned leaders.
In part, perhaps. But the dynamics within this emerging bloc are incredibly complex, as India's Prime Minister Modi demonstrates with his highly calibrated diplomatic balancing act.
That careful diplomacy is truly fascinating. Chinese leader Xi Jinping hosted a gathering of 20 leaders, including prominent figures from Russia, Iran, and India, in Tianjin this week.
Mm-hmm.
During his address, Xi called for deeper economic integration and championed the vision of an orderly, multipolar world, implicitly, though, clearly, criticizing Trump's America First policies without naming him.
Subtle, but not really.
Right. He urged leaders to seek integration, not decoupling, and to unequivocally oppose power politics. China's foreign minister Wang Yi underscored this message, stating that the initiative would provide global stability and definitively end the monopoly of global governance by some countries.
Right. Ending the monopoly.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or SCO, originally founded by China and Russia in 2001 primarily to address Central Asian security threats, has significantly broadened its mandate now to include wide-ranging economic and security cooperation.
It's grown quite a bit.
It has. It's expanded from its initial 6 to 10 full members, with a total of 27 states now participating in some capacity, and Laos just joined this week as its newest full member.
Carla Freeman from Johns Hopkins offers a crucial perspective, though. She views this grouping as primarily united in a sense of aggrievement with the U.S. rather than a sense of common purpose.
Aggrievement, not purpose. That's interesting.
That distinction is vital because it implies a negative unifying force, a shared frustration or opposition to the existing U.S.-led liberal international order, rather than a truly coherent, shared positive vision for the future.
So united against something, not for something.
It's less about what they want to build together and more about what they want to push back against. This kind of unity can be powerful, but also inherently fragile, depending on the evolving nature of that aggrievement.
And Prime Minister Modi's strategy during this summit truly illustrates this complexity and the delicate tightrope many nations are walking.
His moves were very calculated.
Notably, he visited Japan, a key member of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, or Quad, which is seen as a counterweight to China in the Indo-Pacific before coming to Tianjin.
Right, sending a signal.
Furthermore, he will pointedly skip China's military parade later this week. While Xi Jinping publicly hailed warming ties between China and India, Modi subtly but firmly stressed the imperative for peace and tranquility on their disputed shared border as a prerequisite for genuinely improved relations.
Drawing a line there.
He also stated that the relationship should not be seen through a third country lens, which is widely interpreted as a direct reference to Beijing's perceived efforts to exploit India's own tensions with the Trump administration.
Modi's balancing act is a vivid microcosm of the broader geopolitical shifts we're discussing. Countries are increasingly seeking to maximize their national interests within a rapidly changing global power structure, often by strategically engaging with multiple, sometimes conflicting blocs.
It's not black and white anymore.
No, they're not simply choosing sides in a new Cold War. They're navigating a far more nuanced, multipolar landscape. For you, the listener, this dynamic explains why alliances are becoming more fluid and why the old certainties of global partnerships are giving way to pragmatic, often temporary alignments of convenience.
Hedging their bets.
Exactly. It signifies a profound recalibration of power, where even allies of the U.S. are hedging their bets.
Here's where it gets really interesting, connecting these global dynamics to something as fundamental as history itself.
Ah, the history angle.
This reshaping of the global narrative ties directly into how China is choosing to remember and celebrate history, particularly World War II. As China approaches the 80th anniversary of Japan's surrender, it's engaged in a deliberate and extensive campaign to systematically downplay U.S. assistance during the war.
Right, minimizing the U.S. role.
And conversely, to heavily emphasize Moscow's role in its ultimate victory. This selective historical accounting is clearly designed to serve current geopolitical tensions with Washington and bolster its relationship with Russia.
Indeed, the revisionism is quite overt. Chinese leader Xi Jinping has publicly declared China and Russia as victorious powers, and more emphatically, main victorious countries in WWII.
Main victorious countries.
Yes. This rhetoric is echoed by state-aligned scholars, who are now actively arguing that U.S. aid during the war was primarily self-serving, and that China would have a chance of winning even without it.
which contradicts a lot of history.
It starkly contradicts the consensus of many prominent historians. Rana Mitter, a distinguished Harvard Kennedy School professor specializing in China's wartime history, for instance, argues compellingly that American assistance encompassing the crucial Lend-Lease program, the heroic Flying Tigers Volunteer Air Force, and the invaluable guidance of military advisors like General Joseph Stilwell was absolutely crucial for China's survival, and indeed its ability to continue fighting against Imperial Japan.
So, Stilwell, Flying Tigers, Lend-Lease, all downplayed now.
Essentially erased or minimized. The scale of American support, both material and strategic, was immense and undeniable at the time.
The impact of this narrative shift is profound and far-reaching within China. It's being amplified through multiple state-controlled channels, including sophisticated AI-generated videos and a new wave of blockbuster movies that dramatically portray the Korean War.
The Korean War films.
Notably, casting American forces as the aggressors. This deliberate propaganda is systematically deepening anti-American sentiment within China and concurrently drawing Beijing even closer to Moscow in a perceived alliance against Western influence.
It's a powerful and concerning example of how history isn't just recorded. It could be selectively remembered and actively presented to serve contemporary political goals, creating a carefully curated national memory.
Yeah, crafting the past for the present.
This aggressive narrative shaping is happening concurrently with a major internal push to enhance China's military capabilities, alongside the upcoming WWII anniversary parade, which is expected to showcase impressive advanced weapon systems like hypersonic missiles and sophisticated underwater drones.
A big show of force.
There are clear indications that Xi Jinping is unhappy with the People's Liberation Army's overhaul progress.
Unhappy.
Well, over the past 2 years, at least 24 senior military officials and defense industry executives have been conspicuously removed from their positions or have simply disappeared. This is part of what's described as a sweeping and ongoing effort to stamp out endemic and persistent corruption within the PLA, signaling Xi's determination to tighten control.
A purge, essentially.
That's what it looks like.
Xi's ambition is truly colossal.
Yeah.
He aims to completely modernize the PLA to quantitatively and qualitatively match the U.S. military by mid-century.
A huge undertaking.
This includes an audacious plan to build the world's largest navy and a significant expansion of China's nuclear arsenal, quadrupling its warheads from around 200 in 2020 to 600 last year, with an stated aim for 1,000 by 2030.
1,000 warheads.
He has even directly ordered the military to be fully ready for a potential Taiwan invasion by 2027.
That 2027 date keeps coming up. This relentless crackdown on corruption, despite the outward display of military strength we'll witness in the parade, actually highlights a significant internal struggle to achieve Xi's ambitious China dream of national rejuvenation and ultimately global hegemony.
So it's not just about strength, but control.
It's about achieving military readiness, yes, but fundamentally it's also about reinforcing political control and ensuring absolute loyalty to Xi himself within the ranks.
Does the Pentagon think the purge helps or hurts?
Well, the Pentagon, in its latest assessment, cautiously suggests that this purge, while intended to strengthen the military, may have actually disrupted the 2027 goals for Taiwan, perhaps causing delays in some areas.
Interesting.
Though it could, paradoxically, increase overall readiness in the long term by rooting out inefficiency. For you, the listener, this isn't just about military might. It's about understanding how historical narratives are manipulated for modern political gain and the profound internal dynamics and immense ambitions of a rising military superpower whose leader demands absolute control and unwavering loyalty.
It's striking how these current events, both domestic and global, tie into a broader historical reflection. A particularly thought-provoking opinion piece observes that 80 years after World War II, the very consensus it painstakingly forged.
Mm-hmm. That post-war consensus.
A consensus against isolationism and for robust international alliances, free trade, and the promotion of democracy appears to be quite literally crumbling.
This raises an immediate and critical question. When the direct living memory of a global cataclysm like World War II is largely gone, what replaces that foundational understanding of why we built enduring global institutions like the United Nations and NATO in the first place?
That's a deep question.
The article points out a stark demographic reality. Of the 16.4 million American veterans who served in WWII, only a dwindling 45,418 remain. That's a profound generational shift.
Wow, just over 45,000.
Yeah. Former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel warns against unraveling what has worked, cautioning that it's very dangerous to discard decades of proven foreign policy.
But the current administration sees it differently.
Well, current White House officials argue that America First has never meant America only, pointing to recent peace agreements and continued engagement. But the core idea that the world will simply come to us if we are not actively and consistently engaged, as foreign policy expert Ivel Dalder argues, is being profoundly and, some would say, dangerously challenged.
And we're seeing a very significant, almost counterintuitive shift in public opinion, too. Only 56% of Americans in 2024 believe the U.S. should actively engage in world affairs.
Which is a near record low.
It is. What's particularly interesting is how the partisan divide has flipped. Republicans were historically more favorable to robust U.S. engagement, but since 2015, Democrats are now significantly more so, with 68% compared to just 54% of Republicans.
That's a fascinating flip.
Historically, American isolationism often vanished dramatically after direct attacks, like the bombing of Pearl Harbor. However, the current shift is more subtle, more gradual, an erosion over time rather than a sudden shock.
Elliot Cohen, a former top advisor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, issues a stark warning.
Mm-hmm.
We are tempting fate. We are increasing the risk of a cataclysm.
Tempting fate. Strong words.
He emphasizes that the collective awareness that truly dreadful global events can happen and that isolation isn't a viable or safe option in an interconnected world is clearly fading with that living memory.
So forgetting the lessons of the past.
Potentially. This is critical for you, the listener, to consider how profoundly historical memory, or the lack thereof, impacts current foreign policy decisions, and what that ultimately means for the future role of the U.S. in a deeply interconnected and increasingly unstable world. The implications touch upon everything from trade agreements to climate change cooperation and, of course, global security.
Bringing it back home, the economic picture in the U.S. is deeply tied to this political maneuvering and the power struggles we've been discussing. Labor Day this year saw widespread protests across the country.
Mm-hmm. The workers over billionaires protest?
Exactly. And Congress is once again facing another looming government shutdown with significant and very real implications for your wallet and your daily life.
This truly brings home the profound real-world impact of high-stakes political maneuvering in Washington. We're witnessing intense ideological battles over the federal budget, but the question that immediately springs to mind is, what does that actually mean for individuals and families across the country?
Right, the human cost.
And stepping back to see the broader context, an opinion piece from an aluminum foundry CEO in Wisconsin offers a particularly stark and personal view of how these national policies trickle down and affect everyday Americans.
Indeed. On Labor Day, protests under the banner of Workers Over Billionaires took place in major cities like Chicago, San Diego, and Washington, D.C. These events, meticulously organized by the Mayday Strong Coalition, which includes powerful labor groups like the AFL-CIO, along with progressive organizations like Indivisible and Move On,
a broad coalition,
were designed to denounce what they perceive as the undue influence of America's business tycoons and corporations over the second Trump administration. In Chicago, Mayor Brandon Johnson notably chanted, "No troops in Chicago," a direct jab at federal deployments.
Right, referencing federal agents.
Meanwhile, the White House responded by confidently stating that Republicans were once again the proud party of the American worker, highlighting the deep political polarization surrounding labor issues.
These protests directly reflect the economic anxieties that are inextricably tied to political decisions. For instance, the CEO of that Wisconsin aluminum foundry provides a compelling firsthand account.
The one you mentioned.
Yeah. He explains how President Trump's tariffs, which were ostensibly meant to encourage domestic aluminum smelting and protect American jobs, have ironically caused his input costs to triple.
Triple, wow.
Which, in turn, has forced him to raise prices for consumers and, devastatingly, led to layoffs at his own plants. He warns of a tsunami coming, impacting the very workers Trump's policies aim to help.
So the opposite effect intended.
It's a textbook example of how well-intentioned or at least politically packaged policies can lead to unintended and often damaging consequences for the very people they claim to serve.
And speaking of consequences, Congress returns to Washington with very limited time to pass critical spending legislation and thereby avoid another government shutdown.
Down to the wire again.
Seems like it. The Republican caucus remains deeply divided, meaning they will absolutely require Democratic votes to get any appropriations bills passed. Trump's recent pocket rescission of $5 billion in foreign aid, which we discussed earlier, has predictably infuriated Democrats, making bipartisan cooperation even harder to achieve.
Poisoning the well, essentially.
Could be. Previous Republican legislative pushes have included significant funding for mass deportation efforts, efforts to roll back key parts of the Inflation Reduction Act, and proposed cuts to Medicaid coverage for a staggering 10 million people.
Those are major policy fights.
Huge. On top of this, Democrats are vigorously pushing to extend vital health insurance subsidies from the Biden administration that are set to expire.
The ACA subsidies.
Exactly, which could cause premiums to spike dramatically for an estimated 20 million Americans if not addressed.
It highlights the extraordinarily precarious nature of these budget negotiations, especially with such a divided Congress. The potential for a government shutdown means that critical federal services, from national parks to federal employee paychecks, could be disrupted, creating chaos for millions.
Yeah, real disruption.
And the expiration of the Affordable Care Act subsidies could lead to a significant, perhaps insurmountable, increase in healthcare costs for millions more, potentially forcing them to lose coverage. These aren't just abstract line items on a budget sheet. They are direct, tangible impacts on the daily lives, economic stability, and health security of communities across the country. The stakes could not be higher.
Our sources today also paint a picture of starkly different, sometimes conflicting perspectives on law and order.
Always a complex area.
From a massive federal recruitment drive to local legal victories and controversial new school mandates. For example, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, is currently on a huge hiring blitz, aiming to bring in 10,000 new officers.
10,000 new ICE officers.
They've already received over 130,000 applications. And a single career expo in Arlington, Texas, alone, saw 3,000 eager applicants line up.
What's immediately fascinating here is the sheer range of motivations among the recruits. Many, like a former Marine, an MMA fighter, or a retired officer, express a strong, almost patriotic desire to serve, believing passionately in the need for stronger borders and preventing human and drug trafficking.
And the bonuses probably help?
Especially with enticing signing bonuses of up to $50,000. Yet, there are significant contrasting views. Protesters outside these expos have taunted applicants, calling them Gestapo.
Strong language there.
While some recruits themselves dismiss concerns about rough tactics as simply different narratives influenced by social media algorithms, some even express their own moral reservations about the prospect of arresting parents in front of their children. It really illustrates a deep societal split on what defending the homeland truly entails and what methods are acceptable to achieve it.
That sentiment extends to our nation's capital, where the debate over federal presence is palpable. In Trump's D.C., National Guard troops have become a common sight in the metro.
The guard in the metro, right.
Part of what's seen as the president's concerted effort to exert more direct control over the city. Public reaction has been incredibly mixed. Some commuters are openly cussing them out, with one even calling them Trump's goons, while others offer sincere thanks and unwavering support.
A real divide in reactions.
The Guard members themselves are often stoic, stating their mission is simply to make D.C. safe and beautiful. Maryland Governor Wes Moore, however, has been very critical.
Governor Moore spoke out.
He did, calling Trump's politicization of the National Guard unforgivable, stating emphatically, "I would want for someone to fight for the integrity of the job I signed up for," reflecting his own military background.
Governor Moore's perspective, as a former Army member himself, is particularly poignant and carries significant weight. It underscores the profound tension that arises when military resources are deployed in civilian contexts, especially when such deployments are perceived as serving a political agenda rather than responding to a clear, apolitical national emergency.
Blurring the lines.
Yeah, it blurs the lines between military service and political messaging, which can erode public trust in both institutions. The presence of armed guard members in daily life environments like subway stations can also alter the perceived civil liberties landscape for citizens, raising questions about federal overreach and appropriate use of force.
On a more positive note, Baltimore recently achieved a truly significant legal victory, being awarded a staggering $62 million in a ghost gun suit.
$62 million, wow. Against whom?
Against arms dealer Hanover Armory, the largest verdict against an arms dealer in U.S. history, for flooding communities with untraceable ghost guns.
That's huge. Ghost guns are a major issue.
Critically important, because ghost gun recoveries in Baltimore soared an alarming 1,500% between 2019 and 2022 alone, often linked directly to youth crime.
1,500% increase. Incredible.
The city plans to use these substantial funds to support community violence intervention groups, sending what its mayor called a neon bright sign to other dealers that they will be held accountable.
That case is a landmark decision, certainly. It explicitly pushes back on the manufacturer's long-standing argument that these incomplete kits, often sold without background checks, don't legally qualify as firearms until assembled.
Closing that loophole legally.
This verdict demonstrates a proactive approach to public safety, directly addressing the supply side of gun violence in a novel way, treating it as a public health crisis rather than purely a criminal justice issue. It could very well set a crucial precedent for other cities across the nation grappling with the proliferation of untraceable weapons, potentially opening new avenues for legal action against manufacturers and distributors.
But then we have Tennessee, which brings its own unique and controversial approach to gun safety into schools.
Ah, the Tennessee school mandate.
The new school year there introduces mandatory K-12 firearm safety lessons for students, starting as early as kindergarten.
Kindergarten? Really?
Yep. This is the first state in the nation to implement such a widespread mandate, with Utah and Arkansas now following suit. The curriculum is described as age-appropriate and viewpoint-neutral, covering basic gun parts, safe storage practices, and general school safety protocols, notably without the use of loaded weapons.
But the criticism is strong, right?
Oh, yeah. Critics find it absurd to mandate this training for children while adults in the state face significantly weakened gun laws, such as permitless carry and permission for guns on school grounds.
That's a stark contrast.
There are also deep concerns about potentially re-traumatizing students who have experienced gun violence, and notably, there's no parental opt-out provision. Republican Representative Chris Todd, the bill's sponsor, defends it as basic common sense training that, in his view, isn't consistently taught at home.
This really forces us to confront a critical question. When there's such a profound and often irreconcilable divide in how different segments of society view safety and justice, whether it's through increased federal enforcement, aggressive legal action against gun dealers, or early childhood education, how do we as a society even begin to find common ground?
It seems impossible sometimes.
The different experiences and narratives here are incredibly powerful. For a child who has personally witnessed or been affected by gun violence, a mandated gun safety lesson, even well-intentioned, might feel like a re-traumatization rather than a comforting or empowering tool. It highlights the vast chasm in perception and priority.
Beyond the immediate headlines, we're seeing the political groundwork meticulously laid for future elections, offering vital clues about the national mood, especially regarding President Trump's pervasive influence.
Mm-hmm. His shadow looms large.
Even when he isn't directly on the ballot.
What's truly fascinating here is how these local and state elections become a crucial testing ground, a kind of predictive preview for larger national contests.
Bellwether races.
Exactly. While Trump isn't directly on the ballot in these races, views of his administration, his policies, and his political brand are prominently factoring into these marquee competitions. This provides absolutely crucial insights into voter sentiment and the evolving strategies of both major parties as they meticulously plan their approaches for the upcoming midterms and beyond. It's like watching political chess games play out on a smaller board before the grand tournament.
Absolutely. Two closely watched governor's races are currently underway. One in New Jersey, featuring Representative Mikey Sherrill.
Sherrill in Jersey, right.
And another in Virginia with former Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger. Both Democrats are currently leading in the polls, running as centrists with impressive national security backgrounds, and they are actively and explicitly tying their opponents to Trump's agenda, attempting to nationalize these state-level contests.
Using Trump as a foil.
Seems to be the strategy. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, is spearheading a complex ballot measure designed to counter Republican redistricting games that were urged by Trump in various red states, seeking to flip an ambitious 5 congressional seats blue.
That's a big gamble on redistricting reform. The strategic emphasis on tying opponents to Trump, even in these state and local level races, speaks volumes about his continued polarizing effect and how both parties are tactically positioning themselves in relation to his brand of politics.
It defines the battlefield.
For Democrats, it's about mobilizing anti-Trump sentiment, while for Republicans, it often involves navigating his endorsement without alienating more moderate voters. This dynamic will undoubtedly shape many more electoral battles to come.
And in New York City, the mayoral election is particularly intriguing, offering a glimpse into the evolving identity of the Democratic Party.
Yes, the NYC race. Always interesting.
Zoran Mamdani, a dynamic 33-year-old Democratic Socialist State Legislator, is currently the frontrunner. He's campaigning vigorously on a platform of affordability, making bold promises like a rent freeze and entirely free bus fares across the city.
Very progressive platform.
He faces significant challenges from both former Governor Andrew M. Cuomo and current Mayor Eric Adams, both of whom are running as independents.
Cuomo and Adams as independents, wow.
Mamdani's liberal politics and, notably, his vocal criticism of Israel have caused considerable pause for fellow New York Democrats, including powerful figures like Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, neither of whom have yet endorsed him.
That lack of endorsement speaks volumes about party divisions.
Yeah.
The NYC mayoral race especially reflects a broader and increasingly intense debate within the Democratic Party itself over generational change, ideological direction, and what constitutes the most effective way to fight Trump and his influence in the post-Biden era.
It's about the soul of the party.
It's not just about winning elections. It's about defining the future identity and core principles of the party itself. For you, the listener, these elections, from governor's mansions to city halls, serve as critical indicators of broader political trends and the evolving challenges faced by both major parties as they grapple with internal divisions and the shifting desires of the electorate.
Now let's pivot and dive into the fascinating and sometimes alarming world of technology and how it's fundamentally reshaping our lives.
Always moving fast.
From the very nature of image manipulation to how we choose to consume music. A new Washington Post article reveals that scan your face laws for the web are having some truly unexpected and indeed counterproductive consequences.
And this immediately raises a very profound question. In an era where truth can be so easily manufactured, manipulated, and disseminated with unprecedented speed and reach, what robust tools do we as a society and as individuals truly have left to critically evaluate information and distinguish fact from fabrication?
It feels harder every day.
As one researcher aptly notes in the article, we're just kind of reacting to wherever it takes us, which is a deeply concerning outlook when the lines between what's real and what's meticulously fabricated become so incredibly blurred.
It truly is, and the UK's new age verification law, initially targeting websites with adult content, offers a stark case study. Compliant porn sites in the UK saw a significant drop in traffic.
Okay, so compliance hurt them.
But here's the unexpected, almost ironic consequence. Non-compliant sites actually doubled or even tripled their UK audiences in August alone.
So people just went to the non-compliant sites.
Seems so. Compliance with these laws is onerous, requiring users to verify their age through government IDs or face scans using AI software like Yoti. This technology, while advanced, charges platforms between 10 and 25 cents per face scan.
That adds up quickly.
Potentially costing a high-traffic site like Pornhub an astronomical $13 million a day. Unsurprisingly, many smaller platforms are simply blocking UK access altogether, citing disproportionately difficult compliance burdens.
Can't afford it.
And what are users doing? They're turning to VPNs and Tor browsers in droves. In fact, one UK official's public warning against VPNs inadvertently provided what one expert called the slickest free advertising for the VPN industry, causing app downloads to soar.
Huh. The Streisand effect strikes again.
Pretty much. In the U.S., South Dakota and Wyoming are enacting similar laws for anything deemed harmful to minors, a broadly defined term that could, incredibly, include sites like Barnes & Noble or Netflix, with parents even empowered to sue.
The unintended consequences are quite stark, aren't they? Instead of protecting minors, these laws are inadvertently pushing users, including potentially minors, towards less regulated, potentially more harmful, and certainly harder to track corners of the internet.
Making things worse, maybe.
It fundamentally highlights the immense difficulty, and indeed the often futility, in legislating online behavior without creating new, more problematic vectors for avoidance or even danger. It's a classic case of attempting to solve a problem with technology, only to have technology and human ingenuity find a way around it, often creating new, unforeseen challenges.
And speaking of what's real versus what's not, another article reports a truly groundbreaking development. Masterful photo edits now just take a few words.
Ah, the AI image editing.
Google DeepMind's new Gemini Flash 2.5 image model allows for incredibly strategic and surgical photo manipulation with astonishingly simple text prompts.
This is an absolute game changer in the realm of digital imagery, and frankly, a bit terrifying in its implications. The model is not just powerful, it's incredibly fast, often generating sophisticated edits in under 30 seconds.
under 30 seconds.
Crucially, it's excellent at maintaining contextual consistency, meaning you can precisely change one tiny part of an image while leaving the rest absolutely untouched, making the edits virtually seamless.
Like magic.
The examples are mind-boggling. Changing outfits on a person, colorizing old black and white photos, and even, chillingly, adding real people like Kim Kardashian or President Trump to photos without any pushback or refusal from the AI, which previously might have generated abstract rather than literal images.
So it won't refuse to put Trump in a picture?
Apparently not, according to the article. This dramatically amplifies the existing ethical concerns about the ease of generating deeply polarizing images and the frightening difficulty of detecting AI manipulation, especially since the tiny, subtle indicators of AI generation can often be cropped out.
You can't even tell it's fake.
Plus, Google's Syntha watermark detection tool, designed to identify AI-generated content, isn't publicly available, leaving the average person without reliable means of verification.
It's a stark reminder of the challenges ahead. From cutting-edge AI, we now shift to something a bit more analog, an enduring favorite that seems to defy the streaming revolution.
Okay, what's defying streaming?
Despite it being an increasingly streaming world, an estimated 11 million people still faithfully use iTunes.
11 million. Still. Wow.
Making them, as the article puts it, a vanishing rearguard in an era dominated by subscription services.
The reasons for this enduring loyalty are actually quite compelling and speak to fundamental human desires around ownership and quality. Users consistently cite the value of owning their music files outright rather than simply leasing access through subscriptions.
Right, you actually own it.
They also point to the demonstrably higher sound quality. Standard iTunes tracks are 256 kilobits, and lossless tracks have been available since 2011, far superior to many compressed streaming options.
Better sound.
And crucially for artists, iTunes offers significantly better royalties, taking around 30% versus the often minuscule, almost non-existent payouts from many streaming services.
Artists actually get paid.
While the user profile tends to be older, earning it the affectionate, if slightly dismissive, label of a boomer app, it also includes professionals like DJs and dance studio workers who critically need to edit tracks and rely on local file access.
So practical uses too.
Yeah. The persistent concern, of course, is that these loyal users fear the service might eventually go offline entirely, despite Apple's somewhat ambiguous stance on its long-term future.
These stories highlight how technological advancements and the policies and business models that surround them profoundly affect our privacy, our understanding of truth, and our very relationship with media.
And the value of older tech sometimes.
Exactly. They also showcase the surprising persistent value of older technologies in the face of relentless innovation. Now, let's move to the more personal side of the news, as we have several compelling human stories that challenge perceptions, reveal hidden truths, and highlight ongoing struggles.
Maurice Templesman's story, in particular, prompts a crucial reflection on how history chooses to remember individuals who embody such profound contradictions, those who achieve immense success or public prominence, yet whose methods or associations were deeply ethically compromised.
A complicated legacy.
It forces us to ask, how do we as a society genuinely reconcile these vastly different facets of a single complex life? Is it possible to separate the public persona from the private dealings, or do they become inextricably linked in the historical record?
Let's start with the story of Real Housewives of Potomac star Karen Huger. She's being released early from jail after serving 6 months for drunk driving. The article delves into the massive life transition she faces, specifically the immense challenge of staying sober outside of the structured environment of confinement.
Especially in that environment.
Especially for a public figure who is returning to a demanding, often alcohol-centric TV environment. Huger has publicly committed to Alcoholics Anonymous, despite previous public denials of ever being an alcoholic, acknowledging the difficult road ahead. It's a powerful and very public reminder of personal accountability and the ongoing struggle with addiction.
Then there's the fascinating complex obituary for Maurice Templesman, the enigmatic diamond baron. It reveals a truly dual legacy.
The companion to Jackie O.
On one hand, yes, he was widely known as the sophisticated public companion to Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. On the other, he symbolized the often opaque and ethically questionable diamond market, with business interests that required contacts with corrupt tyrants in Africa, particularly figures like Mobutu Sese Seko.
Dealing with dictators.
Templesman sometimes even acted as a de facto U.S. intermediary with these regimes, highlighting the murky intersection of commerce and diplomacy. He was also a major Democratic Party donor, yet was embroiled in controversies such as donating plundered ancient statues, which were later repatriated to Italy after extensive investigations. It's a life that embodies the blurred lines between legitimate enterprise, political influence, and ethical compromise.
And a truly shocking reevaluation of a legendary figure. Sheriff who inspired Walking Tall films killed his wife, authorities say.
Wait, Buford Pusser killed his wife.
New forensic science, which was simply unavailable in 1967 when the incident occurred, now strongly suggests that Tennessee Sheriff Buford Pusser, the real-life inspiration for the Walking Tall films, was responsible for killing his wife, Pauline, directly contradicting his original, long-accepted story of an ambush by his criminal rivals.
What's new evidence?
Compelling stuff. An autopsy revealed she had a broken nose that had healed before her death. Blood spatter was found outside the car, not consistent with an internal struggle. Her head trauma was inconsistent with the car's interior damage, and a close-range gunshot wound to Pusser's own cheek was likely self-inflicted.
Wow, that completely changes the story.
The district attorney emphasized that this reopening of the cold case is not about tearing down a legend, but profoundly about giving dignity and closure to Pauline and her family. The city of Adamsville is now reviewing the painful implications for the Buford Pusser Museum, which venerates his legacy.
That's an extraordinary reevaluation of history, underscoring how scientific advancements can rewrite narratives even decades later, and the relentless ongoing quest for justice, even for historical wrongs.
A hero might not have been a hero.
It challenges the very nature of public memory and how heroes are constructed and remembered, forcing a painful reckoning with truth. For you, the listener, these stories explore the profound nuances of personal accountability, the reevaluation of public figures, and the incredibly complex human dramas that unfold, sometimes hidden, behind the scenes of public life.
Finally, in a situation highlighting workplace tensions and critical national infrastructure roles, an air traffic controller at Reagan National Airport pleaded guilty to assaulting a colleague.
In the tower.
In the high-pressure control tower. He now faces a restraining order request to prevent his return to that exceptionally demanding environment, especially considering the incident occurred amidst intense scrutiny of the tower's staffing and performance after a fatal collision had already put it under the microscope just 2 months prior.
Stress boiling over in a critical job.
It's a sharp reminder that even in highly professional, critical environments, human drama and stress can boil over. And of course, we have a dynamic sports section today, showcasing everything from unexpected debuts and feel-good stories to major shifts in athlete endorsements and the high-stakes drama of playoff races.
Thinking about those playoff races, particularly in baseball, it immediately brings a crucial question to mind. How much does pitching health in September truly dictate October's success? Especially when looking at teams like the Dodgers.
The age-old question.
And more broadly, what does it reveal about the evolving strategies in baseball? From the reliance on small ball to the pursuit of star power and big home runs, the balance feels different every year.
In Major League Baseball, we have the inspiring story of Unsung Alvarez shining brightly in his Nats debut.
Ah, the Nats debut.
Andrew Alvarez, a 26-year-old former 12th-round draft pick, made what's being widely called a miracle MLB debut for the Washington Nationals, pitching 5 absolutely scoreless one-hit innings for a victory that impressively ended an 8-game team skid.
What a debut.
He debuted alongside catcher CJ Stubbs, who had his own impressive story, catching a complete shutout in his very first MLB game.
2 great debuts in 1 game.
Meanwhile, the MVP watch and playoff races heat up MLB's home stretch as the season rapidly draws to a close. We're seeing intense MVP battles with players like Raleigh hitting a remarkable 50 homers, a new catching record.
50 homers for a catcher is insane.
And Schwarber with 49 having a career-best season. Playoff battles are absolutely critical, with the Dodgers' seemingly healthy pitching staff being described as a scary proposition as October nears.
If they stay healthy.
While the Milwaukee Brewers lead their division with their disciplined small ball approach, the AL East is locked in a tight race, and the New York Mets are facing significant pitching woes despite having one of the highest payrolls in the league.
The emphasis on pitching health is a perennial constant in baseball, but it feels particularly acute this year, especially for teams like the Dodgers, who have navigated injuries, and the Mets, who are simply struggling.
Money doesn't always buy wins, I guess.
And the contrasting strategies of the Brewers, relying on small ball, strategically advancing runners, timely hitting, and excellent defense against the star power and big home run mentality of other teams makes for a fascinating, multi-layered final month of the regular season. It's a testament to how different philosophies can lead to success.
In tennis, Naomi Osaka looks like old self after a commanding dispatch of Coco Gauff at the U.S. Open.
Osaka's back. Good to see.
The four-time Grand Slam champion reached her first major quarterfinal since 2021, marking a truly significant comeback for Osaka, who has navigated maternity leave and coaching changes.
That's a huge step for her.
Off the court, the tennis apparel market is seeing a major shift. In tennis wear, it's no longer Advantage Nike.
Oh, who's taken over?
Upstart athleisure brands like Vuori, Lululemon, On, and Hugo Boss are aggressively signing top players like Taylor Fritz, Iga Swiatek, Ben Shelton, Francis Tiafoe, and Jack Draper away from giants like Nike and Adidas.
A real changing of the guard in apparel.
Players are actively seeking distinction and bigger paychecks, leveraging tennis's recent surge in popularity. Nike's strength, however, remains its unparalleled footwear expertise.
This brand war in tennis highlights how personal branding and endorsement deals have become almost as important as on-court performance for elite athletes. They're looking for more than just sponsorships. They're seeking partnerships that offer a unique identity, a strong personal connection, and significantly greater financial reward.
The athlete as a brand.
It's a reflection of the athlete as an individual brand, not just a player.
And a quick, charming human interest story from the U.S. Open. The man who snatched hat from boy at U.S. Open apologizes.
Well, I saw that. Went viral.
Piotr Szczęsarek publicly apologized for taking a souvenir hat intended for a young fan, an incident that went viral and caused significant online backlash. The player, Kamil Mokhtarov, later met with the boy to give him a new hat, turning a sour moment into a sweet one.
Good outcome in the end.
Finally, in the NFL, the Giants hang their hopes on a stacked defensive line, including star players Dexter Lawrence II, Brian Burns, Kayvon Thibodeau, and rookie Abdul Carter, aiming to mimic the Super Bowl-winning Eagles' blueprint for success.
Relying on the D-line. Classic Giants.
This puts immense pressure on coach Brian Daboll, whose job, the article suggests, is very much on the line this season. For you, the listener, these stories celebrate individual achievements, offer insights into the fascinating business of sports, and highlight the dramatic narratives that play out both on and off the field. Finally, let's touch on a couple of quirky stories that genuinely caught our eye in today's post, showcasing some of the more unexpected problems and creative, if sometimes unusual, solutions that exist in our world.
Absolutely. Sometimes these smaller, seemingly lighthearted stories offer a really unique window into the challenges communities face and the ingenuity or perhaps the sheer desperation they employ to solve them.
Right.
It's often where the most surprising innovations emerge.
First, in Foster City, California, they are truly plagued by geese.
Geese problems. A classic local news story.
The city is spending nearly $400,000 in a desperate attempt to manage its Canada geese problem, which includes hundreds of pounds of droppings, significant bacterial contamination, and the birds aggressively scaring children.
$400,000 on geese? What are they doing?
Their multi-pronged approach involves using falcon-shaped drones to simulate natural predators, employing border collies, and deploying remote-controlled water devices. Past non-lethal methods have all failed, and previous plans to humanely cull the geese face significant public backlash, forcing them to get truly creative and expensive.
It's an incredibly interesting blend of high-tech and low-tech solutions to what is, at its core, an environmental nuisance. That staggering $400,000 budget for geese management really makes you wonder if Foster City has accidentally stumbled upon a lucrative new niche market for high-tech animal wrangling and urban wildlife control.
Drone geese wranglers, maybe.
The public backlash against lethal methods certainly means cities are forced to become incredibly innovative and allocate significant resources towards humane deterrence. It's a testament to the complexities of urban ecology and human-wildlife interaction.
And then just a brief mention of an intriguing, almost provocative title from the front page that promises a truly innovative, albeit unusual, solution. An answer to food waste. Maggots. Billions of maggots.
Yes, the maggots. It sounds counterintuitive, perhaps even a bit gross, but let's actually delve into that fascinating solution for a moment because it's much more than just a quirky headline.
Okay, tell us more about the maggots.
Well, it sounds unconventional. Black soldier fly larvae, these billions of maggots, are proving to be incredibly efficient bioconverters. They can consume massive amounts of organic waste, from food scraps to agricultural byproducts.
Feeding our garbage.
Exactly, turning it into two valuable resources. nutrient-rich fertilizer for crops, and high-protein animal feed.
Fertilizer and feed from waste.
Precisely. This addresses both the urgent problem of food waste in landfills, which produces potent methane emissions, and resource scarcity by creating a sustainable protein source for aquaculture and livestock, replacing less sustainable alternatives like fishmeal. We're talking about a process that can divert thousands of tons of waste from landfills, reducing our carbon footprint while simultaneously creating a circular bioeconomy in action.
So maggots are actually helping the environment.
In a big way, potentially.
Yeah.
For you, the listener, these stories offer not just a moment of lightheartedness and curiosity, but also showcase the diverse and often unexpected challenges and even more surprising creative solutions that exist in our rapidly evolving world. Hashtag tech outro.
What an absolutely expansive deep dive today. We've navigated a landscape rife with unprecedented political power plays right here in Washington.
About there.
Explored the active rewriting of history on the global stage. Charted the shifting digital frontier with its incredible tools and profound ethical challenges. And connected deeply with the very human stories of struggle, enduring legacy, and personal triumph.
Indeed. We've seen how quickly narratives can be crafted and challenged, from the intent behind presidential actions and their interpretation in the highest courts, to the wholesale historical accounting of a world war being reshaped for modern geopolitical gain.
It's dizzying sometimes.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it underscores the constant and increasing need for critical thinking, for seeking out diverse sources, and for a nuanced understanding to truly make sense of the complex world around us, rather than accepting surface-level explanations.
Our unwavering goal on the deep dive is always to help you not just know what happened in the news, but to profoundly understand why it matters.
Connecting those dots.
Exactly. Connecting those seemingly disparate dots for a more informed, critical, and ultimately a more empowered perspective on the world.
In a world that is frankly overflowing with information and increasingly sophisticated ways to manipulate it and shape public perception, we leave you with this provocative thought. How do you discern truth and genuinely make sense of the powerful narratives that are actively shaping our lives, our politics, and our shared future?
That's the big question.
What active role do you play in seeking out balanced perspectives, in questioning assumptions, and in holding power accountable, whether that power is political, economic, or technological? We encourage you to keep asking those difficult questions, keep digging beneath the headlines, and relentlessly keep seeking out the knowledge that empowers you to truly understand and engage with your world.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Washington Post for Tuesday, September 2nd, 2025. Until next time, stay curious and stay informed.